listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Happy Thanksgiving. Even though it's a short week this week, I've packed a lot into this podcast episode. I had a conversation with Rick Manning, who's president of Americans for Limited Government. He discussed their Legislator of the Year award that they presented to Iowa's senior U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, as well as just talks about what their organization does and what they focus on. Also, I had a conversation with Jennifer Bowen, who's president of Life Right Action. She used to be the executive director of Iowa Right to Life, a friend of Caffeinated Thoughts. We had a conversation about election night, how pro-lifers did, and also kind of a preview of the legislative session coming up. So before we get to all of that, first a word from our sponsor.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
And we're back. Here's my conversation that I had Monday with Rick Manning, who's president of Americans for Limited Government.
Hi, Rick. Welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast.
Happy to be here.
Good to have you on. And a happy early Thanksgiving to you.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Hey, a question I want to ask just on behalf of our listeners, because they may be unaware. Just take time and talk about Americans for Limited Government, what you guys do and what you're about, and how people can get involved.
Sure. Well, our website is getliberty.org, getliberty.org. You follow us on Twitter at @LimitGOVT. That's @LimitGOVT. You know, Shane, it's a lot like the organization sounds, Americans for Limited Government. We tend to be focused on the federal level because, you know, we don't have the resources to do state by state. But we do get involved in the state fights on occasion. We focus on, quite honestly, we focus on the things that a lot of other people miss. We try to take on issues that perhaps don't have big funders who are fighting over them. You know, things like, there's a lot of money in tax reform, but that's not, we don't spend our time worrying about tax reform because everybody's doing that. We spend our time worrying about things like, you know, if the federal government's trying to take over local zoning through the housing urban development, we go after that kind of thing because that's where government expansion really occurs. It's in those kind of niche issues where people don't actually focus on them. They don't even know they occur until their local zoning board is being told that they have to rechange everything they're doing because the federal government's telling them they have to. So that's an example of an issue that we fought, we won. Against the Obama administration, we ended up getting a rider into appropriations bill, which prohibits HUD from actually implementing the what we called Obama zoning, which is federal government zoning, top-down zoning from the federal government. And it's an example of the kind of issues we get involved in that perhaps you don't read about on the front page of the Des Moines Register, but what you do is you would read about them if we did not win.
That's true. Just a question, since this is the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast, and it's a question I'm starting to ask everybody, including Congressman David Young, who unfortunately was not reelected, as well as Governor Kim Reynolds here in Iowa. What is your favorite coffee drink?
Favorite coffee drink? I have a lot of coffee drinks that I like. I pretty much live on coffee and 5-hour energy. But I will tell you, the coffee that gets brewed in my office is a coffee. The coffee beans are, I think it's Black Rifle Coffee Company. And we put what the guy who does it, he puts a little bit of sugar into the into the ground beans and then runs it through the brewer. And so it has just a little bit of sweetness to it, and very little of the bitter taste. So that's what we actually percolate in the pot in the office. When I go to Starbucks or a place like that, I typically get a mocha.
Okay, cool. So you guys recently, back on the serious questions here, coffee is very serious.
Well, that's really a very serious question.
Yeah, it is, because I people would not want to read what I write or listen to this podcast if I did not drink coffee. So you recently named Senator Grassley, Chuck Grassley here of Iowa, our senior senator, legislator of the year. So why did you pick him this year?
Well, I try to look at who has had the most impact over the past year for freedom and standing up for freedom. And I couldn't think of anyone in Congress who'd done more than Chuck Grassley. I don't agree with Chuck Grassley on every issue. The truth is, there's issues I just flat out disagree with him on. But here's what he did. There's two salient things that he did that matter more than anything else. And he alone really stood up and did them. On the Senate side, he was the only committee chairman who was fighting to try to get to the bottom of the deep state scandal. He was the only one. We had on the Senate Intelligence Committee might as well have been run by the Democrats. The lack of curiosity or willingness to actually look at what was being done by the Senate chairman there, Richard Burr, was astonishing, and quite honestly, it was a betrayal. But Chuck Grassley picked up the mantle. He actually went after documents from DOJ, from the Department of Justice. He laid out a memo early in the year that really laid out that what was happening with the deep state in terms of Fusion GPS and Glenn Simpson, and how they were hiring the creator of the dossier, Christopher Steele. And just kind of unwavering in his determination to try to get to the bottom of what was going on at the Department of Justice, and never gave up on it, and it caused a lot of waves as a result. And as somebody who believes that this is probably the biggest scandal in our nation's history, because it goes to the heart of our own government, our own bureaucrats, trying to determine the outcome of elections. I can't imagine something worse than that. So we've got he stuck his nose in. He didn't have to. He stuck his nose in. He was hardcore on it. So you know that commended him to me. Remember last year, Devin Nunes was our legislator of the year. You know, coming off of his getting an ethics investigation for his trouble of trying to take on the deep state, and you know, so we lifted up Devin Nunes when nobody was talking up Devin Nunes, because nobody knew if he was going to survive the fallout from what he was doing to try to stop the deep state. Well, Chuck Grassley is in the same mold. The people of Iowa should be very, very proud of it. And then we all saw what happened the second half of the year, and that is the Kavanaugh hearings.
Right.
You know, he took a lot of grief.
Which
a lot of grief.
That's the one that got a lot of attention in the state. I don't think a lot of people really realize all that he did to address problems with the federal bureaucracy, but we certainly know about the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah, and you know, that's what, as you said, everybody knows about that. I was really impressed, because he took a lot of grief for the way he proceeded with that hearing, allowing the left to just go nuts. But the fact is, if he hadn't given them he basically was setting the hook for when you're fishing, so you let the fish take some line, and then you jerk them, and you set the hook. And that's what he did with them, is he set the hook. He took a lot of grief for letting them take line and go crazy and do stupid things. But you know what? He defined Cory Booker forever. He defined Kamala Harris forever. He really created, he allowed these people to be just who they are. And in doing so, through his kind of just being a kind, sensible guy, he let them be the contrast to that normalcy. And all of America saw it, and America rejected that. So it was he did a phenomenal job. And he got a lot of grief from both sides of the aisle, because people wanted him to be fighting back in midlife. But what he did instead, He just was smarter than they were and allowed them to make the mistakes so everybody could see it. And then he got the job done and got Kavanaugh confirmed.
Yeah,
he couldn't ask for a better job.
We would not have, you know, seen Spartacus had he not allowed this to continue a little bit. I thought his approach was right. I think obviously they needed to have a point where there would have been a deadline if they couldn't agree to a joint hearing, to be able to question Ms. Blasey Ford. But I thought, you know, people criticizing him right off the bat for, you know, even allowing that. I'm like, if he didn't, I mean, that would have been harmful for the confirmation. I thought what he did was absolutely the right way to go.
Yeah, what proves that he was right is the job got done. And
right.
And as a net, and politically, which is what all this was, all these histrionics were, politically, it was a massive positive for the Republicans. In fact, I would argue that the only reason the Senate picked up seats is because of the way Chuck Grassley handled that hearing. And so when
certainly
you get right down to it.
Yeah, it certainly made a difference in the Tennessee race.
Absolutely. It made a difference in the Tennessee race. I think it made a difference. Now, you get right down to it, we ended up due to some, we're not going to get into the politics of why we lost Nevada and Arizona, but the reality is there could have been a lot of other problems out there in some races. We certainly wouldn't have won Florida. So there are a lot of races that came through that wouldn't have come through. And I think that
right.
Chuck Grassley is first and foremost making it happen. But, you know, in some respects, Shane, just to get back to the award,
uh-huh.
I'm an old Barry Goldwater guy, okay? I grew up with a picture of Barry Goldwater in my house, okay?
So
I look at somebody, are they willing to do what's right regardless of political consequences? That's what I look at. That's what I admire. And Chuck Grassley proved himself willing to do what was right, regardless of political consequences. He was going to fight against the deep state. He's going to fight for the Kavanaugh nomination, not because he has any, because it's the right thing to do. And when somebody does that in Washington, D.C., it's an anomaly. Unfortunately, yeah. It isn't the norm. And Chuck Grassley set a new norm of how you proceed. You proceed by doing what's right. And he had a strong anchor. He knew what was right, and he proceeded to figure out a way to get it done. And for that, in this town, you need to recognize people who do that to try to give others the heart to do the same.
Right. So we learned late last week that he's trading in the Senate Judiciary Committee gavel for the Senate Finance Committee gavel. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it makes sense. He'll do a great job in finance. The Judiciary Committee in this two-year period needs somebody who is a judge, because you're going to have impeachment of the president coming out of the House, more than likely, and the Judiciary Committee will be serving the role of being a judicial body where the chairman will essentially be the chief judge. And that's a role which I think Lindsey Graham will play very well. And so I think that it has everything to do with that. Chairman Grassley is a guy who wants to do what's the best thing for the team as a whole. And quite honestly, being chairman of the Senate Finance Committee is a pretty powerful post.
Oh,
and
right.
He will be, and so it's not like it's his chopped liver. And I would suspect that should the Republicans maintain a majority in 2020, that he will return to the Judiciary Committee role at that point.
Interesting. So you definitely think President Trump being impeached is definitely going to happen.
The Democrats are insane. Yes, they're going to spend the next – they spent this last first 2 years – doing the Mueller investigation, they're going to spend the next 2 years impeaching Trump. It doesn't really matter over what. I think that the Kavanaugh hearing was a precursor to the Trump impeachment, because it was, and they're going to try to use Stormy Daniels payments as the excuse. because they don't have anything else. And it's a, you know, paying an extortionist is going to be what they're going to use as their excuse for trying to impeach Trump, because quite honestly, it makes every one of us cringes over this, okay? Every one of us cringes over it. We don't want to fight on this. But that's what they're, and that's why they're going to use it, because it's going to be really, really hard. But, you know, we're going to get, it's going to be ugly. It's not going to be fun. But that's what the American people voted for. They voted to have a soap opera for the next 2 years, and that's what we're going to get.
Okay, so no hope that any meaningful legislation will get passed in the next 2 years?
Well, I think some meaningful legislation will get passed. I think there's a chance on the infrastructure bill to get something done. I think there's a chance, quite honestly, I think in the lame duck, they may even try to do a budget reconciliation. So in this and next 6 weeks, a budget reconciliation bill between the Republican House and Republican Senate. So you only need 50 votes plus Pence in the Senate to pass something, and they'll try to make the tax cuts permanent, the individual tax cuts permanent, and perhaps try to tag on to that a fix for the multi-employer pension system, which is essentially the union's pensions have, and a lot of the union pensions are underwater. And are going to crash and burn at multi-billion-dollar cost to taxpayers unless something is done. And so they're contemplating a fix to that. And I don't know what that fix is, because it hasn't been released yet. But I think there's a reasonable chance that something will be done on that. Say 25-30% gives the best chance. It's the best opportunity to get something done, and doing it under budget reconciliation would allow them to only need 50 votes plus one to effectively move legislation that will be bipartisan support. But I don't think they'll get 60 unless they have to do it. They have to do it now if they're going to do it.
Okay, we're definitely not going to see an actual budget, though. Probably.
To do a budget reconciliation, they have to do some semblance of a budget, but it'll be the budget that they'll do it around will be kind of what they're actually going to spend, as opposed to the kind of fantasy world budgets that they do. And what they're actually going to spend is what they spent last year plus 1%. So.
Okay. All right, so I want to circle back. You mentioned public housing earlier.
By the way, Shane, just so you know, I don't want them to spend more money. I'm not advocating that. I'm predicting that's what they will do. Okay,
Okay. I mean, it'd be nice to see, spending cuts. I mean, real spending cuts, not, we're not going to raise, you know, not a spending cut.
Right.
We're just not going to raise it as much as we did last year and call that a spending cut.
Well, the fact is we've got a massive budget deficit. We've got a massive budget deficit, even though we got more revenues in last year than we received in any time in history. And we still have a massive budget deficit. And it wasn't because of tax cut. Yeah.
We got more revenue in even though they cut taxes?
Yeah, believe it or not. That is true. Growing economies create more wealth. It was a small amount. It was more on the individual side, and the corporate taxes were lower. But it would be anticipated that we'll begin to see the corporate tax rates dramatically, or corporate tax payments dramatically increase, and the individual tax rates will start seeing the effects of having more and more people actually paying taxes in the economy, rather than the current, you know, the past, where we had a large number of people who are outside of the economy who are working in the black market and not paying taxes at all.
Right. So I want to circle back to public housing that you mentioned when you're talking about Americans for Limited Government. Does you guys are promoting the confirmation of Hunter Kurtz. Why is it important to see him confirmed? And first of all, who is he? for you know, average listener, president.
Right.
Who? Hunter Kurtz?
Hunter Kurtz. Nobody knows who Hunter Kurtz is, and quite honestly, there's no reason to know who Hunter Kurtz is. He's a guy who has been appointed, who's very well qualified to be in charge of public housing, and particularly the part of public housing where they're renting. They're leasing apartments for people who are otherwise would be on the street to actually live in. And a lot of those, there's a certain percentage of those that, you know, those lease departments that fail inspections. You know, they're the classic kind of slumlord situation. Mm-hmm. And in spite of the best efforts of the Trump administration, they've been unable to get the guy who they've picked to oversee that specific part of housing and urban development into place for over a year. And you know, the Democrats obstruct everything. They didn't think Trump was legitimate, so they blocked everything. And it was just and quite honestly, Senator McConnell allowed them a lot of leeway in doing that. If it wasn't a judge, he didn't really push it very hard. But this is one where the Trump administration has gotten hit by NBC News because there was a margin of error level of increase in terms of failed housing inspections under HUD. About 96.4% of the inspections succeed. The place passes. A little under 4%, they fail. Last year, the Obama administration, the fail rate was about 3%. And that's really margin of error. But NBC News decided to do a big report on it on one of their news broadcasts and take the margin of error and make it look like it's a big deal. But the bottom line is very simple. Trump's trying to overhaul the entire public housing system, and he doesn't have the guy in place who's the expert to do it. And, you know, we've got Ben Carson in place, but Ben Carson is a housing expert. So in order for Ben Carson to be effective, he needs the actual housing experts who've worked in this for years and years and years and made a career on this to be in place to be able to implement policy and to direct policy. And the Democrats have succeeded in blocking Hunter Kurtz and others who are policy experts in a number of agencies that have really stopped the Trump administration from even being able to get started to do their job. 2 years in, they're still trying to get their top-level people into place in the face of Democrat Senate opposition, and it's absurd.
Okay, so who are the top people that our listeners need to contact to discuss this?
Well, I think you, first of all, you know, obviously tell Senator Grassley how much you appreciate all he's done. But also say, you know, we need to get some of these guys like Hunter Kurtz. I'll give you another one. There's a guy who I actually worked with at Labor Department who is scheduled to be the head of the Employment Training Administration. And he hasn't been confirmed. It's been 6 to 8 months for him not to be confirmed. And I'm stalling because he's a friend of mine. I can see his face, and I can't remember his name. But nonetheless, there's a focus on Hunter Kurtz. That's one that we need to get. HUD needs to be fully staffed. If people pay attention to Caffeinated Thoughts and the Liberty Features section that's there, I'll be putting up a piece on very shortly on here's who these people need to be confirmed now during the lame duck. We'll have a piece up in the next week on that.
Okay, sounds great. So last question for you, since it is Thanksgiving week, what are you thankful for?
I'm thankful for a sovereign God. I'm thankful for a sovereign God who loves each and every one of us, that we know no matter how the political winds blow, he's in charge. And we're just blessed to be able to be part of his creation and be in his will.
Amen. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, buddy. Anytime.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation I had with Rick Manning. Now moving on, I had a conversation today with Jennifer Bowen, who's today being Tuesday, November 20th, with Jennifer Bowen, who's president of Life Right Action.
Welcome to Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So just wanted to pick your brain and get your thoughts about election night. Now, a couple weeks ago, it seemed like it couldn't come soon enough, and now time seems to be flying by after it happened. So we're going to be, you know, Thanksgiving's upon us, and soon to be Christmas, and then we'll be upon a legislative session. So anyway, I'll shut up and let you talk.
No, you're absolutely right. It was one of those things where it was like, this day's never going to get here. And then it's like, but we need more time. But get
Right,
it over
right.
with. But let's get it over with. And like you said, now it's a memory. And they're talking about 2020 hopefuls in Iowa. So it's like, just stop.
Yay, I'm so
Just
excited.
stop.
Yeah.
Just stop. So no, it was a very interesting election day. I mean, obviously there was many thoughts going into it. We didn't see much polling, heading into
Right.
it, but we had a sense that how things would go. And I went into it election night. I never even considered that pro-life wouldn't just come out completely victorious on top. I mean, I knew the other side is angry. I knew that they were motivated and they had a lot of candidates running, and we can break that down here today. But I just never considered that we weren't going to win. And so going into that night was the very first time that I thought, oh my goodness, what if it's wrong way Fred Hubbell? It just
Yeah.
never dawned on me that he would actually be a viable candidate.
Well,
And so,
I know people watching the polling results early, or the results coming in early, you're like, oh, Kim Reynolds is in trouble. I'm like, wait a minute, stop. They're reporting urban districts for, urban precincts first, and we haven't even gotten to the rural districts or precincts. So it's like, just hold your horses.
which is exactly right. And it was very much, I mean, I think we all knew basically from early on this was going to be a rural versus urban race in a lot of ways. And it was very
Right.
much that way. And I got to a point, it was like 9:05 on election night. And I'll be honest, like, I stopped looking at the television. I couldn't, when they were talking about things that were happening on the federal level, and it wasn't looking very promising for some congressional races and things that were happening even in the Des Moines metro
Right.
to pro-life to solid pro-life candidate incumbents, I just had to stop looking. And I don't think I looked at the television again until well after midnight, because I was like, I can't take it. And it was good that I did from my perspective, because we were losing. We lost some really great pro-life leaders, both in Iowa and on the congressional level. And we lost a pro-life, passionate state auditor. So it was really just, I think the whole essence of that night was just a mixed bag, for lack of a better way to say it, of,
Right.
wow, we really, the other side, we knew the other side was angry about pro-life legislation in the state of Iowa. And moving us in what we would believe for sure is the right direction, the other side is hot, and they showed up.
Yeah, and it seemed like definitely looking breaking down, and we won't know exactly what the turnout was like as far as the breakdown of party demographics and gender demographics and age demographics until the Iowa Secretary of State releases their statistical report. But definitely, I looked at Polk County, I looked at Dallas County, and there was a definite suburban problem for Republicans. I'd never seen Ankeny turn blue. When I saw Ankeny precincts turn blue, it's like it's game over for David Young, for Kevin Kester. I mean, basically, Democrats won all the suburban areas, which is in my political history, as far as I've been paying attention to politics, that has never happened. And I don't know if it's because Republicans didn't turn out, or if there was just a increased turnout by Democrats as well as independent, probably in particular women's, swinging towards Democrats this cycle. I don't think it's anything that's not going to be able to be undone, next cycle, but I don't think this is going to be a perpetual thing. But it was striking to see, and it's like, gosh, no wonder David Young lost. If you underperform in Dallas County and you lose the suburbs in Polk County, you're toast in Iowa's third congressional district.
Right. And you've got somebody with David Young, you have somebody, and Kevin Kester as well, but David Young, for example, he's a guy that he was out in his district all 16 I guess 16 areas all every month. I mean, here's a guy that you never thought would be outworked and outperformed by somebody with lesser credentials. And like you said, as I wasn't watching the television that night, I was talking to different people and their feedback and such. And one area pastor who was very involved politically, he was sharing with me that he had been hearing, and I heard this from multiple people over the night, that door knockers in particular, the suburban women showed up in large number that night because they're mad about the heartbeat bill. There are others that are upset with the fact that we have President Donald Trump. But in particular in Iowa, women have been rallied from the other side in resistance to the fetal heartbeat bill. And I think that that's one of those things that, you know, when it took me probably almost 2 weeks after the election to be able to put out the Life Right Action kind of election breakdown, in part because it was like, we just, you know, having to deal with all of it, even just as human beings, like this is, there's some really profound losses here. Profound meaning not just because we like these people, but because, you know, what are the reverberations from the life side of things?
Right.
And I think it's really important that we, moving forward, we acknowledge that, and that's what we were hopeful with our action alert, or not our action alert, but our alert about the election was, look, it's really important that we recognize what all is involved. You know, it wasn't necessarily one thing, but there are people that are upset about, they're not as happy as we are about our victories over the last 2 years on the life issue. And so does that change our course of action? Does that change our direction or anything like that? I don't think so. But I think that it's incumbent upon us to recognize that that is really what motivated not only the losses of Kevin Kester, Jake Heifel, Peter County here in, you know, pro-life men who were ousted by Planned Parenthood. And Jake Heifel's opponent, she's got pictures of herself being part of the resistance wearing a pink hat. These aren't just like, oh, I'm kind of pro-choice. These are like Planned Parenthood activists that took out those men. And the same with the ones that took out Rod Blum and David Young, activist women.
Now, in Peter County's in his race, I think that was just, that losing that district, I think, was inevitable. Just the way the registration numbers are going, that district had slowly been flipping over the last couple of years towards Democrats. But, you know, seeing us lose House District 44 in Waukee, I'm like, Waukee, you know,
I never thought that was going to happen.
And somebody who was also a Waukee City Council member, I'm like, how does she lose? And she lost, I think, all the Waukee districts except, no, she did. I was going to say one, but I think actually she lost all of them. I'm like, how is that even possible? You know, so one thing I was, when I was watching this race, and until, you know, you got involved and SBA lists got involved and they started really, you know, hammering Fred Hubbell on his association with Planned Parenthood, it was kind of like nobody was talking about that.
Correct. You're absolutely right. And I know from over the last 2 months, we spent quite a lot of time on the road, particularly speaking to Republican Central Committees, for example, with, you know, just how bad Fred Hubbell was on the issue and, you know, launching wrongwayfred.org and all of that, just highlighting or lowlighting how bad he was on what an abortion extremist he was. And I would literally every time I spoke to a group, and it could be rural Iowa, we're talking like Ida Grove, we're talking all over the state in places, Republicans who are very involved, because our goal was this isn't necessarily about changing minds. This is about activating our people to understand that this is an abortion activist that we have to keep out of office. And every single time I spoke, whether it was in Polk County, whether it was in Ida County, wherever it was in the state, every single time I heard from people that literally said, oh, I didn't know he was that pro-choice. Oh, I didn't know he bought a Planned Parenthood. Oh, yep. They said, nobody is saying this. You're the first person that I've heard this from. And that was shocking to me in the sense that it was, but it shouldn't have been, because once you get out of the beltway of all of the commercials, they didn't have the quote unquote benefit of all the television commercials that we had pounded on our heads.
I feel badly for them.
I do too, because they didn't get to see Fred bragging about buying a Planned Parenthood, which is of course now a pro-life pregnancy center. But the reality is people just didn't know. And, you know, people like myself and others like-minded, it's like you can't sleep at night knowing that somebody like Fred Hubble could become the governor. And his first and only instincts are to protect the abortion industry. And not only that, but just talking about government-run healthcare, and we can acknowledge, as the governor has been doing, and alleviate the issues with privatized Medicaid, for example. But what's the alternative? Fred Hubble, whose fiscal management is his number one priority, and he wants the government to make the decisions for special needs adults. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, and he never really could answer exactly how he wanted to, how he was going to pay for doing all that, or mm-hmm. how he was going to bring this back under government control. We never got any answers from him about any of that. One race that really surprised me, because it seemed like everything at the state level was going, at least for statewide officials, was going towards incumbents. What do you think happened, Mary Mosman?
Oh my goodness, I don't know. I want to believe that I don't know, but I think what it comes down to, from what I've been able to just gather from what people have told me, as well as just what I mean, and the number wasn't even close, which is so odd, because mm-hmm. The number wasn't close with Secretary of State Paul Pate either, and so. It was just such a bizarre loss, I thought. And honestly, I think it came down to Rob Sand had, and we don't know the exact number at this point until, final contribution reports are in. But you talk about a race that was bought. It was significantly funded by outside donors as early as last year. They were pouring money in, hand over fist, into that race. And I think because of that, Mary was not in a position where she didn't have the financial resources that he did. He was able to do a couple of commercials. One, and I think you even wrote about it, was funny.
It was great commercial.
It was a great commercial, but it was like, what does this have to do with your job? And or what you're running for. And so I really think it was, from what I can tell, it was just personality. People don't, Mary Mosman, I'm not even exaggerating this. I hate math. Like, I literally hate math. It's just not the thing that I love to do the most in life, but she does. And she glows when she talks about it, and she talks about, and she's qualified. You have a classic example of people didn't care. People didn't care that it's going to cost us money. People didn't care that he's not qualified for the position. People didn't care. They're like, oh, he's funny, and I think he should have it. And she just could not keep up with the funding that went into that race.
Funding I think when you're talking about personality, I know Rob. And he's very, very likable. I'm not saying Mary's not. Definitely more extroverted than she is, I think. I don't want to say she didn't campaign hard, but I do know that he was out there everywhere a lot. And he had, and again, money helps too when you're able to get, mobilized grassroots volunteers to door knock. And he had that going on. I don't think she did. And of course, yeah, certainly ads helped. One thing I think may have hurt her a little bit was not pushing back on the budget when we were having, you know, having to pull from the rainy day funds. I think some people were probably saying, why aren't you raising the alarm about that? Because to say her budget's, you know, I can't remember what she said, but even me as a, you know, somebody likes Kim Reynolds, and I'm not blaming Kim Reynolds about any of that, because I think she inherited a lot of that, but, and of course things with the economy turn and all that. So, but yeah, you know, I thought Mary needed to have a different approach, seemed somewhat a little bit more independent, and I'm thinking maybe that hurt her too.
I think it probably had an effect for sure. I think that it's one of those things that it just comes down to. I don't think it can. You know, let me rephrase that, because I don't think it just comes down to any one thing.
I think that
there were a lot of things that were in play, and his side of things wanted it, and they paid, you know, a lot of money that enabled him to get out, like you said, door knocking and all of those things. And you just, in Iowa, that matters whether you're qualified for the position or not. It matters,
right?
If you're at my town hall meeting in the middle of nowhere on a cold December day. I mean, that matters. And when she's in December on that same cold December day doing her job, you know, it's just a little different. But I do
right.
think that, I think what's been interesting and a little more than terrifying is watching what Rob Sand is doing after the winning. And it's showing exactly, it's my understanding that he was actually saying this ahead of the election. I didn't pay too close attention to that race as others did, because, you know, there were so many races that we were keeping an eye on. So I didn't know everything that Rob Sand was saying as he ran. But one of the things that he made very clear was that he wanted to use his new role as auditor to go after Governor Reynolds on the private plane issue, which, you know, obviously she'd been cleared of already. And so reading that, and then on Saturday he made some tweets that were opposed to Senator Joni Ernst on some actions. I don't even remember the topic, but he attacked Senator Ernst on Twitter on this just this past Saturday. And it seems to be increasingly clear that, which was sort of what people thought was a fear anyway, was Rob Sand does not, well, I don't think that he doesn't have a fundamental understanding of what the auditor does. I think he's transforming it in his mind, what he's going to do as the auditor. And it's increasingly clear that he will seemingly be an extension of the Attorney General's office, going after people that they don't like. And that's concerning. When you look at somebody like Mary Mosman, who has, you know, sniffed out and found almost $20 million worth of fraud in Iowa in just a few years, and you've got somebody who's not as dedicated to that, it's just a little concerning about what are you really going to do in that role.
Well, I think we could definitely expect the managed care organizations to be audited. I think that's definitely going to happen. It should have happened under Mary Mosman. I don't know if there were gears in plan to get that started had she won re-election, but it'll be interesting to see that dichotomy between Governor Reynolds and Rob Sand. And you know, he's the bright shining star of the Democratic Party. I think some people think he might run for Attorney General if Tom Miller ever resigns, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's
I've heard you a senator several times over the last couple of weeks, and who knows? I mean, only he knows, and only the people that he's confiding in know what he's
right.
what he's really about. But I've heard that it was either that he's made it known that he wants to run for U.S. Senate, either against Joni Ernst or Senator Grassley in 2022. Senator Grassley. Well, I know.
I
can't answer that.
I'm like,
he'll be 86.
I know. I was like, are you going to ever enjoy retirement, man?
I don't know. I guess he is. No, he's almost 86 now, so he will. Yeah. That's just it. You know, he's been a great, amazing. So, I mean, he's just doing what he's called to do when he's there, and he's been amazing for us on the Supreme Court level. Now moving into finance, it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. But I don't know. I think, you know, one of the things, and this is one of the things that I heard Senator Grassley say on the campaign trail, I think Waterloo was the first time I heard it. And I think many others in the room was the first time they were hearing it too, based on their reactions. But, you know, his point, one of his points in supporting Governor Reynolds was, he said, you know, who do you want? If he's like, I'm not saying I want anything to happen to me, but what I'm, you know, I'm 85. And what if something did happen to me? I would sure rather it was Governor Reynolds and not Fred Hubbell that was making it. So, you know, I mean, he's 85. He still runs every day, but he also is aware that he's 85, and who knows what 2022 will bring. It was very interesting to me, having heard that Rob Sand was interested in a Senate run, him going after Senator Ernst on a Saturday, cold Saturday afternoon. Mm. So we'll see.
I have not seen those tweets. I'll have to go back and look, check those out. So what do you think is going to happen this legislative session? What are your hopes and dreams, and what do you think is reality?
I don't know that my hopes and dreams and everybody's hopes and dreams are all aligned. I don't know. I do know that, to me, from a, I'm going to use the word pragmatic, but I think from a wisdom standpoint, from pragmatism a little bit, I think that if we as pro-life people were looking for ways to continue to protect unborn children and protect born Iowans, I think that would be how we are best served in the next year or two. I mean, we've gone very, very far with the heartbeat bill, farther than any other state when it happened. And so I think, you know, as it makes its way through the court process, it's very important that we continue to look for ways that we can protect human lives. And I'm just as excited about the heartbeat bill as I was, you know, the safe haven expansion law. I think that if you look back at, and we've got a comprehensive record of everything that pro-life legislators have accomplished in the last couple of years on our website, I think it's been amazing what we've mm-hmm. been accomplishing so far. There's been talk about a constitutional amendment to protect life. I think that, you know, that's something that we've talked about for a number of years. Some other legislation came out ahead of that. And so I think that that's something that you'll hear talked about. Whether that becomes a reality or not, remains to be seen, because I never, ever would suggest that you know what's going to happen in the legislative session.
Oh, wow. Well, not only is it a crapshoot in the legislative session, I'm not entirely sure, you know, depending on the language of the amendment, if, you know, where Iowan voters are at on it, too.
Exactly. Especially, and see, this is where I would probably be in a camp that would part ways with some. And I'm okay with that, because, you know, that's what happens, and, you know, when we all have passions and ideas. But I really think that it's... I really think that it's important for us to learn some of the lessons from election night well. Meaning, like you said, are Iowans ready for a constitutional amendment? Maybe they are. Maybe Republicans and pro-lifers and, you know, conservatives across the state were just not as readily awake as they could have been on election night. And now they're like, oh, wow, we look at what we just lost. I would like to believe that that's the Iowa that I know. I don't know. Or is it, I think those are important conversations that we need to have at the legislature as well as in the state. But I also think that At the same time, there are, and we'll be coming public with a legislative agenda in the very near future. I think there are a lot of ways that we can protect human lives that don't strain everybody quite as far as something like the heartbeat bill did. I think we've made amazing progress, and I think we should be proud of that. But I also think there are a lot of things that we can be doing to protect lives that aren't, that, like with the Safe Haven expansion law, I know I keep coming back to that one, but that's a great example of 100% bipartisan support, unanimous support. I think that there are things that we can do, and we're working with a couple of legislators on some of those ideas. There are things that we can do to continue to move Iowa. Look, I mean, a couple of years ago, we were worse than New York State, and now we're an abortion desert to the abortion supporters. And so that is remarkable. I just think that there are a lot of things that we can do to protect lives. It just may not be quite so aggressive as we've been in the past. I don't want to make that sound like it's weak. I think that we should pay attention to some of the lessons that we learned on election night.
Right. And well, again, until we see a statistical report, it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what that lesson is. Because, you know, I don't know exactly what was, maybe it was Republican turnout depressed. One thing that I was concerned about is our lack of contested primaries, I think, hurt us down the road because we didn't get people on, you know, excited about races, and people weren't turning out, and we weren't door knocking earlier. We weren't getting people registered earlier. And I think that's part of the problem that killed us, especially I looked at that House District 44. I think that really definitely hurt Republicans. But, you know, I mean, you could be right. If the suburban women, if that's what we saw, a wave of suburban women on, whether it's Trump, whether it was the Planned Parenthood mobilizing, I think it's probably a combination of both.
Here's what I think it comes down to too is, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, a marketing issue as much as anything, because the reality is the Democrats, or Planned Parenthood, whoever it is, they never stop. Barack Obama, when he won in 2008, he didn't stop campaigning when he won. And I think President Trump sees this probably more than a lot of Republican presidents and others have seen. I think he sees it a little more clearly than others, perhaps. But the Democrats never stop campaigning. Barack Obama won in 2008, but he kept, I know it wasn't him sending the text messages, but his people, his followers, they're like, oh, Barack Obama just texted me, and he, you know, they're going to have such and such an event on such and such a day, you know, and it was only 2 months after the election. You know, I mean, they continue to stay mobilized. They continue to stay activated. They continue to stay engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I think that's a big piece of it. And I think that we're seeing it even now. I mean, my inbox is just as full. I get all of the Democrat from the state as well as the national. Somehow I got on all of their lists.
Yeah.
And so I get all of it, and they have not stopped. Now, some people are like, okay, that's too much, and I get that completely. But they don't step out and not stay engaged. I think that's a piece of it, and I think that it's honestly Republicans who I adore that we have this tendency as conservatives to know that we have the right ideas, know that we have the right beliefs, and know that we're doing this in addition to working, going to church, raising our families, and this comes after those priorities, and understandably. And we just don't do as good a job as they do on the other side promoting and marketing their ideas. If we did that, I know that we have the winning ideas. I know that we have that we're in the number one state in the country. I mean, that didn't happen by accident, and that didn't happen under Chet Culver. It just didn't.
Right. Right.
And so I think if we competed with them as much as they do a good a job with marketing, mm-hmm. I mean, really, it comes. That's what a lot of it comes down to, is so you're not going to win every suburban housewife over on the issue of the heartbeat bill or Donald Trump. Let's say it's the heartbeat bill, but you can have conversations with people, and then they understand. Oh, okay, I hadn't seen it from that perspective.
Right.
Where instead it's the Democrats that have all of the messaging, and we hate women, and we want to shove, you know, tell women what to do with their bodies and all of that. It's like, no, oh my goodness, we are talking about, did you know a baby's heartbeat started as early sometimes as 16 days after conception? We're talking about protecting women, yes, but we're also talking about protecting that unborn child, you know, that little girl whose heartbeat started 16 days after conception. It's not going to win everybody over, but there are a lot of people that just don't know, a lot of pro-life people that don't know fetal development. You know, I know it doesn't come down to one thing, and it's not, I don't want to make it sound like everything that conservatives are doing is wrong, because I don't think that that at all. Otherwise, we would have a governor, Fred. I think that there are some obvious lessons that we could learn, and I think that it's going to take all of us to do that.
A couple things that, you know, one, just to piggyback on what you said, regarding messaging, it goes back to Republicans can't not talk about this issue, because when we don't talk about it, then we allow Democrats to basically set the narrative. And unfortunately, that's what's happened over the last few years. We need to focus on these particular issues. And one thing, I was happy that the Republican Party finally got this whole Sir Frederick Hubble thing. It's like, knock it off. This is not effective.
There are other ways to beat him.
Especially when you've got Donald Trump.
I know.
We are
Republicans are the party that celebrates success.
Right.
And whether
right.
you were born into it or whether you earned it. I mean, Fred Hubble comes from a successful family, and we celebrate capitalism, and we celebrate that sort of stuff as conservatives.
Definitely. Second thought, as you're talking about how Democrats never stop campaigning, looking specifically at Kevin Kessler's district, his Democratic opponent, I can't think of her name off the top of my head.
Heather Matson.
Thank you. She actually surpassed her 2016 voter total. Not by much, just by a little bit. But it seemed like she retained everybody that voted for her in 2016. Kevin Kessler didn't. So I think there's a lesson there to be learned, is to continue to engage with the people who your base, the people who voted for you, even after the election, because it's obvious that Heather Matson did.
And Heather Matson, and it will come to be known, Heather Matson, now I'm not saying with everybody in her district, but I know Ankeny well enough to know that she was not forthcoming with everybody about how ardently Planned Parenthood she is. She was talking about how, oh, I love children. Every commercial she had seemed like they had little children in it, and she's using them as campaign places of our campaign. She was not telling people that not only was she wasn't telling everybody that she lobbied for Planned Parenthood, that she ran their Planned Parenthood Voters of Iowa PAC. She was sitting, I saw pictures last night of their Bingo-licious out in some gay club in Des Moines, East Village, last week. There's Heather Matson playing bingo. With a big cheesy smile, you know, because she's having fun. She's with her people. I think that it's one thing to be that and own it, and it's another to not be as forthcoming. That wasn't what her campaign ads were. She didn't run on that. She didn't talk about the abortion industry. She was brilliant that way.
Yeah,
and
she was in the district.
Correct. And when she was door knocking them, my guess is that Planned Parenthood came up less, and you know, early childhood education came up more. And you know, that'll you can get by with that one time, because once she gets up to the state house, it'll be more evident where she is on things. But to win in a district like that, she had to be a little more cunning, and she was. And she outperformed, and that's a significant loss. The same with Walt Rogers up in the Waterloo area, a significant loss. The chair of the education committee, a significant loss. Was that on the life issue? Yeah, there's arguments that it was a couple different issues that played into that race, but Planned Parenthood endorsed candidate. They came to play.
It certainly wasn't,
and
the
they won
candidate.
A lot of races.
It wasn't the Democrat candidate's winning personality in that race.
No. No.
Holy cow.
I didn't even know that was in jeopardy. I never even.
No,
like,
I didn't either.
I was reeling from, you know, the Des Moines ones.
I haven't had a chance to really dig down on you know, the precinct data in that race. I don't know how much of you and I, that's part of his district. If maybe there was a surge in millennial voting, that may have been part of it. I don't know. I don't know what that particular race, but it did surprise me. I was expecting him to be in danger.
I wasn't either, and I was very dismayed, as he's a personal friend, that I didn't realize that how much he was in jeopardy. And I think it again goes back to, and I don't want to oversimplify anything because I know a lot more goes into politics than I'll ever even know, or races and precincts, all this stuff. I don't know the minutiae like the experts do, but I do know that some of, and then Walt Rogers' race, I've heard feedback from that some of the things that were passed in the last couple of years obviously played a role in that, whether that was union, whatever that was impacted. And I think it again goes back to the Republican Party was bold and ambitious and did a lot of incredibly progressive and necessary things across the board in the last 2 years. And it became more about protecting seats from the opposition, which is understandable, than here's why we're the number one state. Here's why.
Right.
Our bold, ambitious, progressive moves were necessary, and here's why, and here's how it's affecting you. And taking that messaging away from the other side and saying, here's how it's impacting you. Sure, the unions are upset, but here's why we needed to do that. Because it was, you know, it was antiquated. It had been over 100 years since it had been tinkered with. So this is why we did it. And here's why we think that it benefits the majority of Iowans. I think that, again, it just comes down to the other side is really good. It's why we're still fighting to defund Planned Parenthood on the national level.
Right.
They are really, really good, and this is their only thing. They are committed to it, whatever it takes. And until we match that fire for fire, we're always going to be learning some lessons. And I don't want that to sound overly pessimistic, because I am not by any means. And you know, I mean, we still have a pro-life governor. We extended our pro-life lead in the Senate, I mean, by like 5 seats, which is remarkable. When you consider where the Senate was in 2016, we couldn't get anything through Mike Gronstall. And now we're at 32 seats. That's amazing. And we lost some seats in the House, but we also had, my goodness, they had so many seats come up because of retirement.
Right.
And we still have a pro-life majority there. Thinner, yes. But we still have that. And so I think what's incumbent upon us as pro-lifers in Iowa, is that we continue to encourage our pro-life legislators to look for ways to protect human lives as much as they can. And sometimes, you know, whether that's creative or not creative ways, I think that it's incumbent upon us to encourage them to keep standing up for life, especially right now that we've got, you know, when you look at the House seats, just in the Iowa House as an example, you've got Planned Parenthood endorsed 40 races in the Iowa House, and 21 of those seats they won. So that's, I mean, that's pretty good. They didn't win 19, but they won 21. And my point in that is now we're going to have a whole lot more vocal people, and we're going to need to be surpass them with our encouragement, because they're going to be feeling the heat, because they are, you know, the emails that I keep getting from the Democrat Party since Election Day is, we're back and we're stronger than ever and we're going to do this, and we've got Cindy Axne and Abby Finkenauer, and you know, I know. Did I say tax me?
No, you said ax me.
Okay, because I worked really hard in my head.
I'm not a fan of the Trump nicknames, but I thought I really did appreciate the.
That one, he was at the Council Bluffs rally when he said that, and he was like, right, come on. I mean, like, so he's like, they make it too easy sometimes. It's like, Cindy tax me. So I did work really hard since she's now heading to Congress. I thought, okay, it's Axne, because I never, again, she was one, like Walt Rogers, that I never considered, and it's not like arrogance or pride that I never considered. Mm-hmm. It was just like, David Young has worked so hard, and he's accomplished things in Congress.
Right.
Like, he's, not every congressman in Iowa can come back and say, look, this is what I did, and he and Rod Blubb can. I was so shocked by David Young.
Yeah. Congressman Blum, I knew he was going to be in trouble.
They the Democrats did not want him to have that seat. They were asleep at the wheel in 2016.
Right, and that district is always going to be a hard district for Republicans to hold, I think. Obviously, Steve King, it's just, you know, practically mathematically impossible. Though he had a much closer race than he should have, and I'm gonna be writing an article either today or tomorrow on that. But
he also didn't campaign. My understanding from people in that area and King supporters. He didn't campaign.
I think there's a lot of issues with that, and I want to kind of write an open letter to Congressman King. Because I like him personally. I think he needs a kick in the pants. But anyway, Congressman Young, I was concerned after primary night, when basically his voter registration advantage disappeared.
Mm.
I knew that was not a sign of good things to come. So anyway, you know, one last question I wanted to ask you about judges, because Governor Reynolds will have a Supreme Court pick now that Justice Hetch announced he's resigning due to, you know, his battle with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm frustrated. I don't know about you, but I'm frustrated with Iowa's judicial selection process. I don't know who came up with the Missouri plan and thought that, hey, this is a great idea. But I think it gives too much power to unelected people, and especially the Bar Association. And I think it really limits, you know, the governor's choices. You know, and maybe when a Democrat is in office, that's probably a good thing. But, you know, I still think there's still too much control, and it keeps us from having, you know, having the best judges we could possibly get appointed. So what do you
agreed? Think? Well, okay. I completely agree with you on that. It was interesting. When I was in Ida Grove recently to speak, one of their committee members shared with us that in his lifetime, he's probably in his, I don't want to offend him if he listens, probably in his early 70s. I don't know.
I got tons of listeners in Ida Grove.
I love Ida Grove. I was like, how have I never been here before? So he was talking in his lifetime, they used to have judges ran for their seats in Iowa. Which I was like, okay, well, let's do that again. I don't love that, but at the same time, I was like, well, it'd be harder for them than it is right now. Right. So my point in that is that I don't know yet exactly, some judicial wonk does know exactly that moment that it changed, whether that was in the 70s, 80s, I don't know,
in the
60s,
in the 60s,
I don't know.
In the 60s. And I don't know what, well, if we had judicial elections, I could kind of understand why. Because I think it's like going from one extreme to the other.
Right. And here's where we are. Go ahead.
Yeah, my idea is, I think we should adopt the federal system, but retain the retention elections. Because I don't think anybody deserves a lifetime appointment.
Mm-hmm. No, I think
Yeah, that way the elected officials they're the ones that can make the appointments and then the Senate can confirm, and then they own it, and they can be held accountable to, poor judicial choices, where you can't, I know, like, for instance, people wanted to criticize Governor Branstad back in 2009 when, during when he was running for re-election or for election again, because of his judicial picks, favoring gay marriage. But I'm like, yeah, but time out with this process.
It's not right.
He's choosing the best of three, maybe four options that he's
right.
given
right.
By the judicial selection committee. So
right, who are as far left as they, in my understanding from other attorneys, is as far left as they can possibly go, generally speaking.
Right.
And
right.
I know
I think
the same.
I think that's improved some, but I still think the Bar Association has. They still have pretty much control over the process.
Yes, yes, because he has to, and a lot of Iowans still don't understand that that's the way that the process works, is that he, like you said, with Governor Branstad in 2009, or again in when he had Moore to pick, and then in 2015, all of them, except the one that recused himself, all of the Supreme Court justices ruled against the Board of Medicine on webcam abortion.
Right.
I've talked to Governor Branstad several times about it, and I'm not overstating his dismay on that. But again, like you said, until we figure out how to fix this problem, frankly, I think that's what should be the number one priority of even the pro-life community or whoever it is. Like, until we fix this problem. Until we
right.
address the issue of the Iowa Supreme Court, we have, look what they did to the voter ID bill. They all but gutted it. I mean, we have some, but not what it was.
Right.
It's across the board on,
it's like they went even further than the Supreme Court did in Planned Parenthood v. Casey. I mean,
in 2015, they promised us they would do that. They promised the Iowa Supreme Court, in their supremeness, being my understanding from the people that know these things, were the second most liberal Supreme Court in the nation. So we're not even close to most states with how liberal our Supreme Court is. And the Iowa Supreme Court said in 2015, when they overturned the Iowa Board of Medicine's decision on webcam abortion, they essentially said, here's why all these, we know better than all of these doctors. And essentially, if you bring us more decisions like this, we will find a woman's right to an abortion in the Constitution. Because Planned Parenthood asked for them to do that as well, in their ever overreach. And so they did.
Now,
So they used the 72-hour waiting period to do what they had already promised they would do. Now, that's not fair to whether it's pro-life or whether it's whoever. It's not fair for a Supreme Court to be able to have the authority to say, to threaten you. I mean, essentially, threaten a body of the majority of Iowans who did not want, 66% of Iowans polled by the Des Moines Register did not want webcam abortion. And the Iowa Supreme Court says, oh, we know better than these doctors, and here's what you're going to get. They have too much power.
In this waiting period ruling, and Justice Manfield pointed out in his dissent that they were appeared to be setting up, finding constitutional right to taxpayer funding for Planned Parenthood, basically, if that question ever comes before them. So I'm like, wow.
And Justice Manfield, he's the one that is such a godsend to conservatives that pay attention to such things, because he's also the one in his dissent last summer when the Iowa Supreme Court determined that parents could sue a doctor for wrongful birth, wrongful life. Justice Manfield was in his dissent, basically wrote the framework for what would become legislation that Representative John Jacobson put forward, and which got the legislature to actually resist and overturn that Supreme Court decision successfully in this past legislative session. So, I appreciate very much a clear-headed thinking Justice Mansfield on these issues, but the root issue is, until we solve the Iowa Supreme Court issue, but people who are much smarter than I need to really address this, because we're going to keep losing. What's the point of passing amazing legislation on any given topic to have it now? It used to go to the Senate to die when we had Gronstall as an impediment. And now they're down to, they have Attorney General Tom Miller, and they have the Iowa Supreme Court on that side of things.
Guaranteed.
But that's all they need.
Yeah, guaranteed the state won't defend it.
Correct.
And then the Supreme Court will.
And the Supreme Court will rule. Now, that being said, somebody in the governor's office last year very articulately explained to me that there are, I'd never even knew that justices aged out in Iowa. Nobody was talking about that. There are some that begin aging out in just beyond 2020. And honestly, they're aging already, and you've got two that have retired this year because of physical issues. So who knows? But again, the Governor Reynolds could have an opportunity, and this is not saying this is hypothetical. She could have an opportunity to replace all of them, but mm-hmm. they're still, like you said, they're not necessarily on the Supreme Court level anyway. District court's a different thing. Right. They're not, she's beholden to the list that's in front of her.
Yeah.
And that's what I think Iowans need to understand, is that until we address that and somehow fix it, we don't stand a chance.
Well, Jennifer, we've been talking a long time, so I'm going to let you go. It's going to be a jam-packed podcast, because I've got another interview. I'm adding this as well. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And we'll have to chat again during the legislative session.
That'd be great. Thanks for the opportunity again, Shane. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. And to you. Bye.
Bye.
That concludes today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinatedthoughts.com, or you can just Google Caffeinated Thoughts and we'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails. That way you don't miss a single update, a single article. Also, you can listen to this podcast using your favorite podcast app, whether that's Apple Podcasts, and if you happen to listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please give us a 5-star rating. Also, Google Play, we're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify, we're on SoundCloud, Podbean. If there's one that we're missing, you know, drop me a line at shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, and we'll see about getting, you know, the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast using that platform as well. Until next time, my friends, first of all, have a very happy Thanksgiving, and take care. This is Shane Vanderhart signing off. We'll see you next week.